started. And, you know, entertainment out of Randy Bodelain isn't much. I've already been told no jokes. So this is absolutely serious. Everybody has an NAR number, and I got a couple of door prizes. Every kid that walks in this room is going to get a door prize today. What's so if you're an A, I'm going to define kids. Hang on. If you're an A or a B divisioner, you're a kid. All right? And I gave you a prize already, right? Right. You're over there nodding. But I got a few more prizes. I don't want to carry them up to my room. And this is an extra large. So I knew better. But anyway, some donations from Rocket T-shirts. We got a couple of door prizes here. And I'm going to pick an NAR number out of the hat to give it away. So if your NAR number is 82361.
That's your number, Randy.
No, it's not.
He doesn't know his NAR number.
82361, you won a prize. Okay, 82362.
You know the probability of getting a number from me in this room?
363. Okay, who's next? 823-something.
Who's closest to that?
Who is? Who's closest? I was just, like I said, I was drawing it out of the top of my head. Amanda, what's your number?
18337.
Oh, that's it. That's Okay, I had no idea what number was that. How about an older number, since there's a lot of old-timers in here?
Thank you.
Speak for yourself.
53911.
That's not old.
53911's not old?
No.
It's got to be old enough to wear an extra large. What was that number? 53, what'd I pick? 539. Who's 539? Anybody close? 53 anything. Okay,
yeah.
Top one. All right, an extra large feature. Let's give him a big hand. And now may I introduce the president of the NAR, the guy who only does, what's the angle thing? Tracking. Mark Pundit.
Yay.
Oh, he changed jobs this year. That's right.
I did change jobs. And I appreciate you giving me that chance there, Mr. Prentice Director. It's been a while since I was in that saddle, and I really enjoyed it today. I only screwed up one flight. Apologies to Tom Lyons, who was the victim of my lack of recent experience. I'm in experimental mode these days with some elements of the management of the NAR, and this meeting is going to be an extension of my tendency to experiment. The NAR board is traditionally met before NARM started, and this year we chose not to do that. And I chose to do that change in the schedule. We'll be meeting the Saturday after NARM, after the awards banquet, for selfish reasons. I did it because NAR board members, like everything else we do except headquarters, is run on a volunteer basis. And asking people to give up vacation time in front of the NARM, as well as participating in the NARM, is a heavy burden. So by doing our meeting on Saturday, the number of days of vacation that NAR board members have to use from their professional lives is reduced. So we're going to see whether or not we can make it through a week of NARM with enough energy to sit down on Saturday morning at 8 o'clock and start going through the bulk of our business. We're also going to meet here on Wednesday afternoon in an effort to get some business done as well. What does that mean for you here? Traditionally, I've run a town hall meeting and then gone into the association meeting. I want to change that protocol tonight. I'm going to call the meeting to order, the official annual meeting of the association. I'm going to conduct some business in there, which will include the process to allow you to vote for candidates who are running for seats on the Board of Trustees. And then I'm going to ask for a motion to recess that meeting and then conduct the town hall meeting while the ballots are being tabulated. When the ballots have completed tabulating and we're done with the business of the town hall meeting, then I'll bring the formal business meeting of the association out of recess and finish up the business and announce the results of the election. Everybody with me on that?
Right.
Then I'm going to call the meeting of the National Association of Rocketry to order. Mr. Secretary, do you have a quorum?
We do.
Okay. First order of business will be to read the minutes of the last association meeting. The chair would entertain a motion to dispense with the reading of those minutes.
I so move.
So moved by
Bonnie.
Second.
Second.
Who's the second? Okay. With Lynn Thomas. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign? Okay. One opposition. Thank you very much.
Loyal opposition.
We're all non-existent.
Okay. Is there any old business to be brought before the association? Hearing none, is there any new business to be brought before the association? None, then I'm going to turn over the meeting to Jennifer Ash Poole, who is the trustee designate to manage the election process, who will tell you how that's to be done and what you need to do to vote. Okay. After she is done with that, then we will have a period of polling, and then I will look to recess the meeting until and start the town hall.
Hello. I'm having to remember something. I have to open the floor for any nominations from the floor for elections. Do we have any nominations?
To what offices?
To
the board of trustees.
Board of trustees, the three board of trustees that the elections. Hearing none, I close the nominations. All right. My helpers / victims. Jack Haggerty will be coming up here. There's a list of people, all who registered for NARAM. And if you voted, it says you voted. If you didn't, you can come up and see Jack, and he will check you off and hand you a ballot. If it says you voted and you don't think you did, you can go back and see Joanne.
Joanne Rocker,
who's walking. Also, the RCP process, rule change process, is going on, and Mr. Filler here will take your rule change process as well. He's got ballots, I think, so you can come talk to him on that.
So you have two ballots. You have the RCP ballot if you haven't voted for rule changes in the pink book, and you have the trustee ballot for the election of members of the board of trustees.
So we had a problem, we decided to go ahead and join it here. So, here are the white ones. He knows who's voted. We have a list. So, if you are wanting to come up and vote, please come see Mr. Haggerty. We have orange ballots. Once you're done, put them in the box. If you need to do your rule change proposal, please come see Mr. Haggerty.
Thank you.
Having proceeded with the election, the chair would entertain a motion to recess the meeting until ballots are counted.
I so move.
I second.
Wow, same story. Now let me talk about the protocol for this portion of the meeting. It's a town hall meeting, right? It's an informal meeting. You don't have to keep straight Robert's Rules of Orders or the NAR bylaws, but there are a couple of simple rules. If you want to speak, you need to raise your hand. And believe it or not, everybody here doesn't know you, even though you've been coming to NARAM since you were 3 years old. So you need to identify yourself and tell us where you're from, just so we know who you are. So you just have to raise your hand. When I acknowledge you, you say, I am Mark Bondick from Woodstock, Illinois, and then proceed to speak, right? So let's do that, okay? Second rule is that the NAR president has a very crummy input port mechanism. I can only listen to one person talk at a time, okay? And I'm willing to wager that most of you are the same way. So please, one person talking at a time. Those are the only rules for. So I want to talk about two or three things to get the pump primed, if you will. The first thing I want to talk about is safety. Okay? I did this at NARCON, I did it at NARAM last year, and I'm going to keep doing it, right? Because safety is important. And I think our attitudes about safety still need some shifts made. The first thing in that regard that I'm going to tell you tonight is that power lines are not funny. The NAR has had a rash of power line incidents that have dropped in my mailbox this flying season. You want to hear about them? Here's the first one. Club sends me a message, says, we put a rocket in a power line. We asked the power company to come out and pick it up for us. They did, and they sent us a bill for $1,800. Will the insurance cover this? The answer is no, because there were no damages involved. This is an expense. So if your club lands a rocket on a power line and the company sends you a bill, can't claim it as insurance. Okay? The second incident, my good friend Mario Perdue had the misfortune of having one of his flyers at the NSL land a G-powered rocket on the power lines at the field in Muncie, Indiana. After the event is over, there was a power failure in the Indianapolis area that knocked power out for about what, Mary? 4.5 hours or something?
About 5 hours.
About 5 hours to about 2,000 customers of the electrical utility.
Closer to 4,500, actually.
Okay. Who's counting when we're that high? The power company claims that the reason that the power outage occurred was because this rocket draped on the lines. It was draped across all three phases. There was a rash of thunderstorms that moved through the Indianapolis and Muncie area that evening, and they claim that is the source of the problem that they had. I'm now sitting on a bill at NAR headquarters for $4,300-some-odd to pay for the power outage. Guess what? That would be covered by insurance, except there's a $5,000 deductible. The last thing, and this is the least fun I've had with power lines, was there was a flyer in an NAR launch put a rocket on the power lines. He was directly instructed by the range safety officer, do not retrieve the rocket from the lines. We have an arrangement with the power company. They will come pick it up. This flyer proceeded to retrieve the rocket from the power lines. Thank God he is not dead. Okay? That's a direct violation of the NAR safety code. The bylaws say I have to convene a disciplinary hearing. I've convened a disciplinary hearing. They're proceeding with a disciplinary hearing and whatever disciplinary action they choose to take against that member. We cannot be launching rockets, landing them in power lines. If you are landing them in power lines, first of all, for God's sake, don't try to get it down. And second of all, if you're landing them in power lines, you need to look at where you're flying and think about what you're going to do to make sure that no more rockets land in power lines. You're not supposed to be flying so that you have problems like that on your field.
There was a news article on Dig this year about a volunteer fireman who tried to retrieve a rocket from power lines and it killed him.
Okay, that's 5 and 10 years. Up until I heard that story, there are 4 people in the past decade who have died trying to retrieve rockets from power lines. If you want to die with this hobby, the fastest way to do it is to try to climb up on a power line and get it down. Please don't. Other things you need to be thinking about at your club meetings is Ted Cochran, the safety committee chairman. He will be here later this week. He's put together a very good outline that you can use in a club meeting to talk about safety on your ranges. If you haven't already done so, I recommend that you get the outline. Ted will be happy to provide it for you. It's on the file section of the section list server, and go through it. Take a half an hour at your club meeting to go through it. The other thing that Jay Apt, the person who wrote our last safety study, Launching Safely in the 21st Century, did, was remind us that NASA has safety standouts for all kinds of reasons. And I think we can adopt that concept, and we've already started doing this in my local club at Woodstock. When we have a flight that goes wrong, the people who are out there running the range stop and take an assessment and say, what happened to that flight, and what do we have to do to make sure that it doesn't happen again? We're not looking to embarrass the people who are flying rockets. All of us crash rockets. I've done it twice so far this year at this event. Right? I did it at the NSL. I burned a hole through Mario's glass deflector there, one of my great embarrassing moments, captured forever by Tom Beach.
Brand new glass deflector.
Oh, no, not that.
And probably next soon to be in the magazine.
I hope to God not, but you never know. You need to stop and say, what did I do wrong and how am I going to fix it? Okay? Nothing more complicated than that. And the simple act of keeping flight statistics about what kind of errors you're having on your ranges will prove to be of great insight to your club members. Chute's not coming at it. Maybe you need to take a 15 minutes your club meeting to talk about how to pack parachutes. If you have a lot of kids flying your rockets and they're bringing in Estes kits with those shock boards, maybe they aren't the greatest in the world. You need to think about what's doing. We need to do this on an ongoing basis. It's not a one-time thing. You have to do it every launch. And I think until we do, I'm going to keep preaching to people about safety. So these are simple things to do. It's not complicated. A couple of things I have noticed, that have changed, I think, much for the better. There's an increased awareness about fire safety on ranges. Mm-hmm. Thank you for doing that. You know, people are starting to think about what equipment that they need and to be prepared to fight fires on the ranges. The other thing I see people being more cognizant about is flight trajectories and wind and making sure that they have positioned people and property out of the way. Murray and I went through an exercise at the NSL where we did that. We had a rocket prang. Didn't expect it to prang there, but we stopped flying until we fixed the problem. We moved the people. And people don't necessarily like it when you do that. When Mario asked the lady to move, she was all huffy about it. Spectator coming from the local area. I said, lady, if you want to get hit by one of these rockets and die here, that's okay with us, but you know, maybe we think it would be better if you would just move down the road just a little bit. And she did move. So please, take those kinds of steps. And I think people are being more proactive about those two elements of safety. And I would encourage you to engage Ted Cochran when he's here later this week about safety issues or talk to him about his suggestions he might have. Who are you? Where are you from?
Steve Loveliner, Tucson, Arizona. Is it possible, perhaps, to solicit some of the companies to sell fire equipment, even with a low-cost ad or something, for Rocketry magazine, so people have an idea of some of the sources for equipment, like Indian pumps?
I think that the simplest equipment you can take out to a range, believe it or not, is a rake.
Yes.
Raking the fire is far more effective than lugging water in many cases for the kind of fires that we're fighting. I think you need to talk to Ted. Ted, by the way, he has a background as a volunteer fire company, and he says beaters or rakes are far more effective than water in most cases for the kinds of fires we're fighting. But again, you need to talk to Ted about the specifics there.
Mike Rankin's from Saginaw. I went out on the support range yesterday afternoon with an E9 spitted.
Yeah, awesome. Okay. And how would you put it out?
Grab the water can and run out.
Okay, but that's fine. But that's part of the reason that we have them there. But for those of you who are looking, if you don't want to spend $150 or $200 on an Indian pump, bring your rake.
Lynn Thomas, Indianapolis. Fire extinguisher closed?
Fire extinguishers, dry fire extinguishers, are not effective generally against grass or paper fires.
There are still water fire extinguishers. They can't be gotten.
I would recommend you get a rake because you've probably got one in your garage, and if three of you bring them, then you're going to have some effective firefighting equipment.
John Dyer, Dallas, Texas. We do use rakes. We also usually have just jugs of water, industrial strength size jugs. Orange juice or whatever, when you empty it out, just put a little bit of chlorine in there to keep the water good.
All good ideas, and again, I encourage you to talk to Ted. From my perspective, I don't care how you choose to be prepared to fight the fire, right? Be prepared to fight the fire. If you got enough money to buy Indian pumps, great. If you got rakes, bring it. If you got jugs of water, bring it, right? Just be prepared and be thinking about that when you have a hazard like that on your ranges. The next thing I want to talk about is our friendly local neighborhood Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. My friends at 650 Mass Ave Northwest. As many of you know, we had a status hearing scheduled in the U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C. on July 27th. At noon on July 26, counsel got a call from the clerk of the court saying, Judge Walton has canceled the hearing. You don't need to appear tomorrow morning. I was fighting the traffic on New York Avenue when that happened, pulling into Washington. Ken Good, the Tripoli president, was stuck in the Charlotte, North Carolina airport waiting for his connection to Washington. So he and I proceeded to go to Washington and have a conversation that night at dinner with Marty Malsh, one of our lawyers, to find out what the story is here. Pay no mind to any of the legal speculation you see on the internet about why the hearing was canceled and what the motives are and what it means. There's no legal meaning embedded in the fact that the status hearing was canceled. There were no documents due in front of the court at that time. All of the documents had been filed back in April. The court didn't need a status hearing, and I think Reggie just figured out that he didn't need the status hearing. Where do we go from here? Okay. Reggie is a contestant on The Price is Right. He gets to pick door A or door B. If he picks door A, he would issue a call and schedule a court date to hear oral arguments on the papers that have been filed. If he wanted to do that, our counsel's speculation is that he would have done that by now, and he would have changed the status hearing to be one on oral arguments. So we don't believe that he's going to pick door A. That leaves him with door B. Door B means that he has to write an opinion, decide the case, and then issue an enforcing order of some sort based on the opinion that he's written. So counsel's best bet right now is that's what he will do. When he originally ruled on this kind of lawsuit back in 2004, this is exactly what he did. Parties filed motions for summary judgment. They filed responses to those motions of summary judgment. And then they filed a rebuttal to the responses. And then he issued an opinion and an order. And if you recall that process, that sent us into the appeals court because we thought Reggie made a mistake. So now he gets to do that again. And he has to do it in the context of that appellate court ruling. Don't know when that will happen. His clock is ticking because this is probably the oldest case in front of the D.C. Circuit. And he's coming under increasing pressure from the chief judge at the court to adjudicate the case. And if there's any further delay, then he's got to be telling his boss why he needs to delay. So he's got to call us back in for oral arguments to explain the papers that have been filed before he has to issue an opinion. If you want to talk about what happens after that opinion is issued, again, it's a door A, door B thing. Either the ATF wins, and he supports their arguments about why ACPC needs to stay on the explosives list to be regulated, or he will support our opinion and say it's not an explosive. Regardless of which one of those he chooses, the nature of the opinion will determine what the nature of any appeal might be. If we lose, then our counsel has to look at the opinion he's written, look at it in the context of case law, and decide whether or not any elements of it need to be, it could be appealed. And the same thing for the ATF. They would have to look at this opinion and say, is there anything about this that we think an appellate court would overturn? And then decide to do it. They would have 60 days to make that decision after the ruling. They would have 60 days to tell the court that they were going to appeal it to the appellate court. And we would have 30 days. The government gets more time. What a surprise. In either case, we're going to have to defend if we win and the ATF appeals. And if we lose, then we're going to have to assess what the legal conditions are under which we could appeal. This case is pretty tightly bounded in the realm of administrative law, and there's not a whole lot of maneuvering room for either party, to be perfectly honest. But I think we need to be prepared to face an appeal, either us appealing or them appealing. And I'm going to need more money to do that. So to the extent that those of you are asking, what can you do? Unfortunately, it's the same story that I've always told you is, we need more money to continue to fight these guys if we have any hope of winning. Steve, or
you don't know.
Steve Humphrey, New Jersey. How many more appeals can happen? I mean, we appealed, and if he says boo-hoo.
Supreme Court.
Well, the next stage up after an appellate court ruling would be to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court gets about 4,000 requests to hear cases a year, and they do 70 of them in a busy year. The counsels fight us for from the start that there's nothing about this case that would have any generate any interest in the Supreme Court hearing arguments. They don't believe that the Supreme Court would hear, even if we or the ATF tried to go that route if they got an unfavorable ruling from the appellate court.
Okay, so what I just heard is that even if there's an appeal, it's not going to go anyplace.
No, there's a three-judge federal panel who can look at what a district court did with a single judge and say, you screwed up. And that's basically what they did with our appeal back in 2005. They said, oh, this order, an opinion that was issued by the district court was wrong. And they told, they said, we're sending this back down to the district court for another pass at this, because we think they made a mistake.
And so this could, in theory, could cycle.
Remember that when they did that, they set a legal precedent. If you read the opinion that the appeals court issued, they said, the ATF has failed to demonstrate by their own measure why this material needs to be regulated. We are sending this back down to the district court. And the district court then said, hey, ATF, you screwed this up. I'm giving you another chance to get it right. Now ATF has produced 2,199 pages of evidence along with a bunch of video that purports to show why the material is an explosive. And they filed that stuff. And we've said, Your Honor, that's hooey. And now the judge has to rule about whether or not the ATF has met their obligation under the appellate court rule.
Right, and door A or door B or whatever it was is yes. Perhaps another appeal.
No.
I'm sorry.
The door A, door B thing was what does Richard Walton have to do?
Right.
He either has to decide or hear oral arguments and then decide.
Yeah, okay, but it could result in another appeal.
And I don't know what the context of that will be because we don't have an opinion.
I'm sorry, I'm not asking my question properly.
How many cycles can this go through?
It just seems like, you know, we've appealed or there's been an appeal. And
every stage of the game, it's hard for people who haven't read all this crap, and I have, to see this. The legal avenues that are open to either us or the ATF to pursue are being narrowed. Okay? And the appellate court ruling narrows this very specifically. They said, you, the ATF, said, you will establish the burn rate is the criteria that you're going to use. Establish the burn rate. And tell us why this material meets that specific criteria that you've set. So unless there's some other error that's been made in that process, this case is running out of gas because the legal avenues are narrowing down. And in my opinion, my observation as a layman and counsel's observation, Reggie Walton has made no judicial errors that could result in a review where they could say to the appeals court, Reggie Walton screwed up.
So it's possible but not likely.
I think they have to come up with, you know, and again, it depends on the nature of the opinion that he writes, and we won't know that until he writes an opinion about what the nature of it is. Right? The ATF, in my opinion, will not go quietly into this good night. They're not going to give this up very easily. But their legal options are becoming much narrower very quickly.
Chris Taylor, Levittown, PA. Was there anything potentially damaging in that ridiculous 2,200-page document? I mean, did they have any leg to stand on?
In my and my counsel's opinion, no.
Stephen Fleur, South Bay, Michigan. If we win our case,
yes.
Does that mean all high-power rocket motors will be totally unregulated and die over the counter like coffee, or what?
I don't think. I almost broke out into a hymn, oh, happy day.
What can we expect?
What can you expect?
What's the best case scenario?
Now, the best case scenario is that Reggie Walton will write an order that said, you, the ATF, here's the opinion, you failed to meet the standard. This material is not an explosive. Here's an order directing you by the court to remove ACPC from the list of regulated explosives in the United States.
Yay!
Joe Holly, Ferndale, Michigan. Just hypothetically speaking, if you go to another round of appeals and this process drags on past 120.09, what's the likelihood that a different administration will take a whole different...
Independent of the administration, you're dealing with the judicial branch of the government, right? And I don't think that the administration, upon change of the administration, the ATF will remain as it is.
So they're not, they wouldn't just drop it.
Okay. Two things. One, this kind of hypothetical speculation I don't think is very productive for me because... I've gotten really focused about law, right? Okay, I've spent 7 years of my life reading this stuff and reading law, and Chevron might be an oil company to you, but it's a major legal precedent case to me, okay? That's how bad this crap is, right? Okay. I've been going to law school for 7 years, okay? All right, so I'm a terrible student. You know, until an order is written, I can't tell you what the legal change might be. In the process, right? Either by us or them, and that's why I say I you know, all the speculation I read on the internet, I just laugh at because until the order is written, you can't really say. And it's really specific to the order and the opinion that the judge would write. Okay. And the change of the administration, in my opinion, the ATF has a culture that operates in a particular way. I was warned that that was the case when we started. I didn't necessarily believe it, but now I do. They have a particular way of doing business, which is, we're right, you're wrong, shut up, sit down. And, you know, very simple. And I don't think that will change with the change of the administration. Republican, Democrat makes no difference. This culture is embedded in that agency.
Roy Green, Atlanta. The discussions that my club and other clubs around the country have been having with Gary Bangs, with the ATF, are they... helpful or not helpful, or is there something that you...
Anything people hear, I'd love to hear about, right? I want to hear about people having trouble getting permits, getting goofy opinions from ATF field operatives. You know, I like hearing all of that stuff, just to know what to expect.
But is it useful, or is it something...
From a legal standpoint, relative to where we are in the litigation,
right.
No.
Okay.
All the paperwork's been filed, and again, this is a case in administrative law, right? It's not about goofy things the ATF is doing in the field. It's about what they have the right to do given the statute and the case history that applies to that statute.
To judge things.
So, again, whatever we do with that, it's not hurting the case or it's not helping the case either.
No.
So, okay.
I don't think it does.
Okay.
And I would be surprised if it... resulted in operational procedures that were consistent across the country.
Yeah. Larry Curcio, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I was wondering whether, if it threatens to go to another round of appeal, and I know this is anathema, but if there's any possibility of negotiating with them and saying, okay, grant us regulatory relief under these circumstances, and you can on the explosive list or something like that.
I went to Washington four times in 1999 attempting to do that before we brought the litigation. I went back and tried to do it again in 2002 when the court said, why don't you guys go see if you can work this out? I went again after the 2004 TARC because Ross Ahrens, who was a special assistant to the guy heading arson and explosives, Lou Graydon, was convinced that the meeting might be of some use. I had six trips to Washington. It cost me about $600 every time I go. Right? I got nothing to show for that money. Nothing. Doesn't negotiate.
I know it was a dumb question when I asked.
Oh, it's okay. Sit down, shut up, do it our way. That's the story I get.
That's kind of how I get with the discussion with Gary Banks was, oh, yeah, this all sounds good. Your suggestions sound good, but we'll do it our way. Thank you very much.
And I know this is hard for you guys. Trust me, it's hard for me too. Now, I read through all 2,199 pages of that crap, taking it apart.
I have our sympathy.
You know, That was, you know, a couple of weeks' worth of nights and weekends work to make sure I got these guys. But, you know, the council said we could save a lot of money doing it, so I did it.
This crap digitized?
Yes, I have it in digital form. If you want the PDFs we have, all 100 megs of it, I'll be happy to,
cool.
Happy to ship it.
Is there any thought of possibly, since the ATF is in the executive, to, you know, go up the feeding chain in the executive? Something like presidential order would.
Yeah.
Which is going to side with reducing regulation.
In 2000,
and aliens have visited.
In 2003 and 2004, we attempted to pass legislation that would have granted regulatory relief to rocket motors of 0.9 pounds of propellant and less, up to 50 pounds of storage of those rocket motors.
Right.
Part of the legislative process requires the administrative branch to issue a letter. They have the option of issuing a letter to the Congress saying, here's what our position is on this legislation that's been promulgated. The administration's official position on the legislation at that time was that these rockets can be used to hit tanks at 5 miles and airliners at 30,000 feet. We think this regulation, you know, this legislation should not be passed. That was the official position of the Bush administration about that legislation.
I had a better chance taking part than to go to jail.
Not happening. We're getting a court order. Or we're not getting anything.
Larry Curcio again. In the model airplane community, they use chainsaw motors, and this is all radio controlled. Can a chainsaw motor be used against a tank or to fly it against a
target? I don't know, and B, it doesn't have any bearing on the legal fight that we're waging. We're waging a legal fight against the explosives statutes and regulations in the United States. The airplane people have their own problems and issues to deal with. And that regulation, I think, would be principally within the FAA, who is trying to figure out what to do with UAVs. Example, some people would like to use UAVs to do traffic reporting. Flying helicopters around with reporters in them is very expensive. You built a UAV with a camera on it, you could put a lot of those up in neighborhoods and fly them around and get your traffic reports. Well, what happens when the engine quits on one of those? Where are these things crashing? What happens to it to make sure you have control? What should be the licensing around operators? Could somebody do something stupid and nefarious with those airplanes?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Probably. Okay. Mm-hmm. The FAA is wrestling with that problem, right? But it's not part of the ATF's legislative mandate. They do not have statutory authority to regulate that kind of stuff. So, not in my food chain, legally speaking. Again, I know this is really frustrating for you guys, and I wish I had clearer stories for you. I wish we had this thing boxed in. We don't, but we're committed to a path. Unless we stick to it, unless we fight this thing all the way to the end, we're not going to get what we need in order to keep the hobby we have. No other way that we can make this happen. If we don't win this fight, high-power rocketry, in my opinion, is going to be restricted to a very small number of sites, people who have the ability to get explosive storage. Either that or there's got to be some fundamental shift in the way the product gets from the manufacturer on the rocket ranges and use. And that's going to be really hard. If we're dispensed with my favorite agency, let me talk about another government agency, the Federal Aviation Administration. In June, the FAA promulgated a notice of proposed rulemaking in the Federal Register. They said, we want to go back and review all of the stuff about rockets that's in FAR Part 101. Now, this was not a huge surprise to me because this item had been calendared many, many months ago. The FAA periodically reviews all of its regulations, and they cycle through all of the federal air regulations. And this was Part 101's turn. So the fact that they issued the NPRM did not catch us completely flat-footed. After I've looked over the NPRM, It turns out that I was going to Washington for this court hearing, so I called up the gentleman, Phil Brinkman, who's listed in the FPRM, and said, I'd like to come in and talk to you about this. He said, well, we'd be happy to sit down and talk with you. We can't really engage you in dialogue because we're prohibited by regulation from doing that one-on-one. We'd be happy to listen to what you have to say and enter it in the docket, and we will encourage you to file comments on the docket. So on Thursday afternoon, I went and visited the FAA for about an hour. The nature of the conversation I had there I thought was quite good. The basic message that I got from the FAA is that we value and want your input, but we want technical input. That is, we're proposing these rules. If you think these rules are wrong, you have to give us some technical reasoning behind why you think that rule is wrong and what you would propose instead. And I said, well, that's quite excellent. We can do that in a lot of ways. A couple of things that I talked to them about, the process was I wanted to get that input. I put these issues on the agenda for the NAR board meeting, and I want the NAR board to work with me, and certainly I will listen to what people have to say here at NARAM about the FAA proposed rules. I want the NAR board to help me generate this technical input and prepare a response that the NAR will file on behalf of the association in response to the NPRM. When I do that and I have that draft, I will circulate it among section leaders. I will encourage you to please distribute it to your clubs. We will put it up at the NAR website. I want people to start filing comments. And if it's a comment that says simply you support what the NAR does, or maybe you have your own ideas about how this will work, please go do that. I also encouraged Ken Good to go and see the FAA, given that our court hearing was canceled. His flight wasn't out of D.C. until later in the afternoon. And I said, call up this guy at the FAA, go over there and see him, have a conversation. He and I are going to have a conversation by phone after the NARAM, and I'm going to find out what he heard. Here are the kinds of things I talked to the FAA about. One of them is there's a rule in there that, if strictly enforced, would prohibit flying rockets, high-power rockets, Class 3 rockets, as the FAA proposed rule calls them, within 5 miles of any airport. Now, I know we have a number of launch sites that are within 5 miles of an airport, and I also know there are clubs that are actually flying off, directly off of airports. And as long as that activity is integrated properly with the air traffic control system to the satisfaction of the FAA, there's nothing that should prohibit the activity. So I said to them, you have field experience that says this can be successfully done, and yet you've written a rule that appears to prohibit it completely. That doesn't look like a good idea to me. You are asking for information about these Class 3 rockets that seems to be inappropriate. The preamble to the proposed rules talks a lot about, well, the real thing that drives our concern about these rockets is the total impulse, because total impulse derives the flight performance of the vehicle. And therefore, we think total impulse should be a major factor in determining how we regulate these rockets. I said, yeah, when you ask us for information about these rockets, you want to know about the propellant and the recovery system and the launcher and all of this. What's that going to do with total impulse and flight performance? That rule doesn't make any sense to me on a technical basis. If you have some other technical reason for doing this, then you should have, made it clear in the writing of the NPRM why you wanted it. They leave in place the distinction between Class 1 and Class 2 rockets, which are we currently know as model rockets and large model rockets. I said, same story. If total impulse is driving you to write these regulations and how these rockets perform, the only two things that differ in the definition of those two are the weight limits. And I said, I guarantee you I can design a rocket that weighs 16 ounces, has 4.4 ounces of propellant, so it will outperform a 53-ounce rocket with the same propellant in it. So we don't think you need to have that distinction in there. If we were able to convince the FAA of that with the right technical data, that would be a huge win for the rocket community, because then we would dispense with these notification launches. It would be a big benefit to our TARC teams and benefit to a lot of people who are flying those rockets. Get clear of the FAA. So I'm cautiously optimistic relative to how we're going to end up with the FAA.
Chris from Levittown, PA. I don't know about you, but based on what you just told me, it sounds like the ATF had a chat with the FAA before this came up.
The wager an adult beverage of your choosing and more that that's not the case. This is part of a regular cycle of review of regulations in the FAA. It's about 6 months past the original due date.
Oh, the review, yes, but the suggestions.
Nope. I think this is entirely generated within any FAA. Based on the people that I know there and the contacts that I've had, this was generated by the FAA entirely. They sought no input from other agencies about these rules. Any questions about that part of life in the NAR?
What's the due date
for? Due date is September 12th. So it's about a month from now, about 5 weeks. So plenty of time to do that. Let me talk about some things that are going to happen in the board meeting. I've talked about the reasons why we shifted it. We go through a standard process on board meeting. We go through financials. We go through membership statistics. We go through member submitted items. The big items that I see on the plate for the NAR board here, in addition to having some further discussion about the ATF and the FAA, are these. One of them is we're going to review a set of information that's been provided to us by Sports Services. Sports Services Committee is run by Carl Polanco, and he has created a new test for Level 2 certification and new material we want to review that explains that process to people. This test was sorely in need of updating, and Carl and a team of people have been working on that probably since right after NARAM last year. So we're about ready to roll out new Level 2 test materials. Tom Lyon has provided us with a completely exhaustive set of information about competition flying in the United States. Which events have been flown, how often, how many people have competed over the past, 7 years or something, what kind of contests have been flown, how many rule changes have been submitted, reviewed, approved, etc. There is an ongoing discussion within some parts of the competition community about what, if anything, could be done to improve the numbers of people who are participating in the activity. And the NAR board is going to go through some of that. I don't know actually where that discussion is going because it was a little hard for me to assess where NAR board members' thinking was on this. But you guys are the avid competitors, and you see what goes on out there in the field. I would strongly encourage you to engage people on the NAR board about any ideas you have or opinions you have about what, if anything, we should be doing to tweak, revamp, change, modify, amend competition as an activity here. I'm willing to take the chance that this will be a discussion that doesn't necessarily get us anywhere, simply because I thought that the discussion that I saw initially generated was a genuine interest to try to get more people involved in the activity. And I'm willing to spend an hour in an NAR board meeting, which is a pretty fair chunk of time for us, to see whether or not anything comes of this. There's no specific proposal on the table one way or another. It's an open-ended discussion, and it may lead us to do some further analysis, and I've talked to some of you about what kind of analysis I think needs to be done. So we may well end up continuing to study the problem without necessarily taking any action. I would encourage you, though, for those of you who are concerned about competition, particularly in the aspects of rules, to engage Jim Filler while you're here and say, have we ever thought about doing a rule change that does this in order to make things simpler, easier, better, whatever. I mean, that's what his job is, and he's interested in talking to you, and he does know what he's talking about. Another aspect that's going to come up for review here is standards and testing. Standards and testing has done a tremendous amount of work that most people don't see in terms of executing the triennial recertifications that are behind NAR motors. They've tested hundreds of them, literally, over the past couple of years, filed those statistics for us. They've also spent a fair amount of time, I think, pretty thoroughly documenting what policies and procedures they have in place. They have a very large policy manuals written by S&T members that we're going to review. That review is a byproduct of a motion that was passed a year ago at NARAM that directed S&T to complete that work for us, and they've done that. And so now we get a chance to go back and engage them in some conversation about what's in there and what additional items, if any, we want, or to fully understand exactly how S&T is doing its business. So they've really been quite busy, even though they may not have been on the forefront of your radar in the midst of everything else that's going on with the ATF and other items of any of our business. They're in the background quietly doing the work that we've asked them to do. They've done a good job of it. The last major thing that I see on the plate for the NAR board here is to review the work that's been done by the Special Committee on Technology that's led by Jennifer Ash Poole. And again, this is another one of those, to borrow a term from advertising, a quiet company that's been working in the background at a problem that probably 3 weeks ago I suddenly came to realize was a hell of a lot bigger than I understood. And the principal problem that I think the NAR board needs to address here, and I'll have this conversation with them in quite some detail, is that this committee's effort is seriously under-resourced right now. We've asked Jennifer to take on too big a job with not enough resources in order to do it. And I think the NAR board has to stop and realize what she's facing and make sure that we've given her the resource that she needs in order to succeed. And knowing Jennifer as I do, I know that she'll work and has worked really, really hard at this, trying to crack this nut for us. And now we need to go and help her and get her what she needs, money, time, talent, whatever, in order to complete the job. Jennifer spent, what, a day and a half at NAR headquarters reviewing process and procedures there with Marie and, you know, enjoying some time with Marie, who was a lovely person if you've spoken with her on the phone or met her in person. We want to attack that piece. The other two pieces of the technology effort now that have become clear to me is we have still have a fair amount of work, I think, to do at the NAR website. Again, Jennifer's been working at that quite steadily with Terry Moore Reed, the webmaster. Have more work to do there, but we're engaging more and more NAR committees to use the infrastructure that she and Terry have put in place. We're in a product called Movable Type that will give direct control and access of information at the NAR websites to the committees responsible for it. We won't be single-threaded in that process anymore, and that's a good thing. It's taken a lot longer for us to get there than I like, and I know that you like, but we have the right technology in place to do what we need now, and that's critically important, in my opinion. If we don't lay that infrastructure down, then we're just continuing to overload volunteers who have to read that process for us. The last thing we've done is we have removed from publication the Model Rocketeer. We did that principally because of input that we got on section surveys that said, you know, that thing's not a real big benefit to us. Now we've got to figure out how we're going to use technology to replace it. And whether that is a blast distribution of email or whether that is some PDF distribution of a Rocketeer-like publication on an as-demand basis, I don't know what the technology solution is behind it. But it's part of the technology project. And again, now you can see how the scope of this thing is expanding. My experience as a project manager, the fastest way to fail is to expand the scope you've assigned to the person responsible for the effort and under-resourced. That's a road to failure. We can't do that. This is too important for us. So we're searching for ideas about the right communication vehicle so that we have a way to clearly, consistently, and in a timely way communicate information about association business to you. We don't think that print is necessarily the way to do that, particularly when we were on a two-month cycle anyway. Those are the things that I see happening relative to the major issues the NAR board is going to have to deal with on Wednesday and on Saturday. A couple of other things that you probably want to know about is what's going on with the membership and what's going on with money. The membership is essentially flat. It's about 4,500, and I think on a statistical basis it's been that way probably for 3 years roughly. So we're not going up, we're not going down. I continue to be concerned about that for two reasons. One is there's some anecdotal evidence that says America is abandoning craft hobbies. People who put things together and build things and whatnot, the interest in those hobbies is steadily declining as we move further into the 21st century. I don't think we can swim against that tide, so we have to be careful about our expectations around membership. The other thing I'm worried about is that people keep coming and talking to me about marketing the NAR, and I'm still in the hunt for a professional marketing person who helped me with that activity. I have a nibble from an NAR member that I'm just engaging in conversation about taking that on. I think until we get some professional help around the marketing aspects of the NAR, we're not going to have very much success in that. It's going to be kind of hit or miss on the ground. rather do better than that. On money, Stu McNabb has spent a lot of time putting together our financial statements. I have a complete set of those here for review. Last year, the NAR ended up with a surplus of about, somebody here on the NAR board helped me remember this number, I want to say about $14,000. Now, before you think that's a lot of money, that's about 3% of the total money that's flowing through the association on an income basis. So we're not getting rich in a hurry, but we are effectively managing the resources that we have under our control. And Stuart does a very good job of making sure that that stays that way. We are going to need more money, though, if we have to go down this appeal process with the ATF. We're looking for people to help us with that, and you'll see me issuing more calls for that money as we get further down the road in that process. But I'm not uncomfortable with where we are on the money basis right now, and Stuart isn't either. Other questions, issues?
Mark Johnson, Kansas. Regarding money, do you have a plan to try to negotiate with the Indianapolis Power Company, or are we just going to shut up and pay them?
I'm going to have a conversation with the NAR board about that, about how they want me to do that. My inclination personally is to pay the bill and swallow hard and in order to retain the field. I think that field is critically important to having a center of high-power rock tree activity twice a year for the NAR.
I guess the question is, Bonnie, stepping back and looking at it, is exactly what action can we take to keep Rockatell power lines?
Good question.
Problem. Chris Kelly from Levittown again. I heard you mention a couple times where clubs have arrangements with power companies
yes.
to handle rockets.
Yes.
It would be interesting to talk to different clubs who have this arrangement and see if we can set up a standardized process of enabling this arrangement with power companies.
Good point.
So it doesn't cost $1,800.
Right. When I was made aware of the problem Mario had with the power line, I called our insurance agent, Bob Bloomster, and he engaged a claims representative. We didn't know how big this was going to be. So there was a possibility we could have filed an insurance claim for the payment, right? It's under the amount of the deductibles, so the insurance company's not involved in the action. But I spent a lot of time, and Mario spent a lot of time on the phone with his claims adjuster. And I asked him about that, actually. I said, well, you know, some of my clubs get these rockets off power lines, it doesn't cost them a dime. It varies by the electrical utility. Some of them think it's important enough from their operations and public safety to get stuff off the lines, and they'd rather have people to call as opposed to charge them. Because if they charge them, they're afraid people won't call, and then it'll cause a problem for them. So that, unfortunately, that experience is varied across the electrical power industry. It depends on the company and how much financial pressure there is.
Also, how close to the transmission station.
Okay.
George Gasman, Homewood, Alabama. Could you possibly get in touch with some national organization of electrical companies, something along those lines, and perhaps work out an arrangement that could create a national basis on how to handle this?
Maybe we can even exchange with them some. You know, we'll do education on electrical stuff in exchange for the service and things like that.
Anything else?
Yes. One thing you said about keeping the field leads me to ask you that if we should tell the power company to stop it, does that mean we're not going to fly there anymore? Even though it's not the power company's field?
That's part of the dynamic that's there, right? And some of you may be familiar with this unfortunate history. We used to use the AMA field, and then the AMA asked us to leave, and now we've worked to get it back. So if they have a problem with the electric company and it's going to create a problem for the AMA, their choice is pretty simple. If I'm the AMA executive director or president, I say, get those rocket guys off my field.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's a fine place to fly rockets for those of you who have flown there.
Matt Johnson from Grand Rapids, Michigan. You were talking about engaging more members, and one of the things I noticed when I was I'm a new member this year, and as an adult, $70 to join is you know, modest. Okay, that's a little bit higher than I like, but that's okay. But as far as the, okay.
And I can virtually guarantee you we're probably losing money on that trade.
Yeah.
And not a good thing.
Well, I guess the question is it more important to get the more members to keep things active instead of...
I have a bias in my philosophy around that,
yeah.
Which is that if you don't pay attention to the money,
right.
You're going to go out of business and then you won't be able to do anything for anybody.
Right.
You know, that's my MBA talk.
Ultimately, it's very difficult to make money buying something for 50 cents a piece and selling it for 49.
Yes.
No matter the volume.
Bob Kaplan, Dundee, Illinois, just to add to what Mark said there, if you've got youngsters that are family members and you do the family membership option,
yeah.
It's only $13 a year.
Okay. I'm obviously not fully aware of the price.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Bonnie Johnson, Kansas. And I know in addressing your issue, and something I brought up with you, Bonnie, is the fact that the model Rocketeer is gone probably because it wasn't bringing in enough money.
Well, no, I don't think we see it as a cost-effective way to get members' information.
Yeah. But you have to realize also, and I know I've talked about this with you, but for members in some of the rural areas, we don't have access to anything but dial-up.
Okay, but again, I'm saying I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah.
The answer may not be to send everybody a 2-meg PDF file that's the Rocketeer.
Mm-hmm.
It may be to say to Contest and Records, here's the way when you need to tell somebody about your activity that you get an email blast, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's very small, that doesn't constrain you. And when S&T needs to do that, here's how they use that same vehicle, and they send it whenever they want,
mm-hmm.
right? Or when I want to send a message, I send it whenever I want, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have to figure out what the cost-effective way to do that is. And
yeah.
If we do that, then we have another problem, which is we've got to go through and validate, update, and maintain all the email addresses. And anybody who's been doing that business, you know how much fun that is, right?
It's just as big a job as validating and certifying postal addresses.
Exactly. So, I mean, I don't know what the solution is, Bonnie. We're going to try to do this in a sensible way, but I don't think print's the vehicle to do it anymore.
Steve Loveliner, Tucson, Arizona. You mentioned about our partnership with 4-H. Now, is there anything that we in the local sessions can do to reach? Is there a structure in place for us reaching out to 4-H or anything?
Okay. A couple of things. Vince Hughley, who's the Education Committee Chairman, will be here on Wednesday. Okay. He is the guy who is spearheading the NAR's effort to build that partnership with 4-H. 4-H hits about 4 million kids a year. The same thing, 4 million kids a year, right?
Wow.
There was an hour-long meeting in July with the 4-H that said, here are the things we are going to do. They were explicit about, we are going to do X, we're going to do it by this date, and you... You know, different people in the 4-H and the NAR are responsible for making this happen. There's a definitive action plan behind that that we're going to review with Vince as part of his Education Committee report here, and I would strongly recommend people get engaged with him. We have stuff in the pipeline, too, Sport Rocketry Magazine that's going to be coming, that we'll talk more about the partnership and the specifics.
So there's no guidance in the interim right now?
In the interim right now, there's not guidance, no. I don't have it for you yet.
Bonnie Johnson, Wichita, Kansas. We are very much engaged with the 4-H, and the comment with the 4-H in Kansas is that it's a whole lot cheaper than raising a sheep or a cow. They like it.
Yeah, they're flying model rockets.
So you can get them, and they like it.
How appropriate, given where we're flying and the names of the Rangers.
Very easy, Chris Taylor. Very easy technical solution to your email blast problem. You give every NAR member, narnumber@nar.org. They're responsible for logging in and keeping the forwarding address updated. It forwards to whatever address they give you. Problem solved.
What problem will get to?
It'd be a work to get it set up once. Well, it'd be work to set up once, but once it's done, it's done.
Chris will help.
I have no idea.
I don't think it's quite that simple, Chris. That's an interesting
idea. That's the thing. It's hard work to do once.
I mean, you know, what we want to do is make sure that we can get to all NAR members, right? I think we need to be more proactive than simply pushing it back to you to say, you update this. I think we have to do something more than that.
Mark McReynolds, California. Talk about 4-H got me wondering. I know over the last few decades, the NAR membership distribution with AIDS has been a bimodal, two pumps kind of thing.
Still,
can you speak briefly as to is there noticeable shifts in either one of the humps as we stay at around 45 members? Are we trending older and...
Yes, the organization is getting older.
Smaller.
No, the organization is getting older. My assessment of the statistics is that the size of the junior and leader memberships is holding relatively constant as a percentage in the organization. We're just getting older.
Larry Curcio of Pittsburgh again. I was wondering, is there anything that we can do more at the college level? I mean, that hits the age group where we've got the trough. And I see a lot of placards around with Newton's third law on them, and they're beginning to make me sick. I felt maybe if we had something with more substance that we could involve college educators in, maybe that would fill in the place where we're losing.
I guess a couple of comments. My anecdotal experience with that is that kids in college are busy sorting out their own personal and professional, potential professional lives.
I
have college-age daughters, and I'm watching them do this.
Absolutely agree. I'm talking about addressing the educators rather than the kids.
And so my second comment is in that regard, right? The NAR is still a small institution, and our ability to get at resource to direct to education is focused currently on high school and middle school students because we've had success doing that. We have a partner who wants to work with us on improving the participation at that age level, and we're gonna walk that path before we either go down the food chain into elementary school or up the food chain for collegiate activities. We have to figure out how to do this and have more success at this age group with the resource that we have currently.
I'm just thinking that this hobby begs for something on the order of Mandel, Capolasso, and Bengen, but something in the 21st century that you can distribute to some educators just to get it in the pipeline and to have it available for others who want to get into it.
I think development of that curriculum would be really hard, and again, I think we've got to focus on this effort to make this current path succeed with high school and middle school students deliver the target.
Doesn't the SLI address that?
Or no, again, that's a high school kind of program. Yes.
SLI started as a high school, and they've just started in onto a college one. I know NASA's now starting to get into that. I've had to review some of the college SLI team as well, and then to talk about a little bit with education reform.
Okay, that was
they started at the high school and they've just gotten into it.
Whose initiative is that? I know nothing of
it's
SLI.
NASA
has a student launch initiative. The top 25 teams from the TARC are invited to submit proposals to participate in this, where they, in essence, run a payload oriented project for a rocket, just as you would if you were a professional scientist asking NASA to fly your payload. The 10 teams are selected for that process to go down to Alabama and fly the rockets down there and interact with NASA engineers in a 2.5 or 3 day program. So follow on to the TARC.
And they've expanded that to the university level as well. It's pretty.
What, Chris Taylor, what has the impact of TARC been on NAR so far?
Oh, in my opinion, an awful lot. Here are the things I see from TARC. One, there's been a small increase in membership of people in that level. Not, you know, it's not like hundreds, it's tens, but, you know, that's one place. Second thing I think is the impact that it's had on new people. The first year we had TARC, we had 120 people volunteer to be mentors to these teams. The next year we had 220. The number keeps going up because people find out it's such a hoot to help these kids and watch them learn about rockets. So it's generated a lot of positive enthusiasm within the NAR to interact with students, and I think that's a benefit to us even if the organization doesn't get bigger. The third thing it's done is it's put the NAR, it's put this image in the mind of people like Robert Gates, the Secretary of Defense. NAR, rockets, kids, education. That's plugged together. That food chain is plugged together in the front of these aerospace executives. When the Secretary of the Air Force tells me that this is a great program and he hopes we'll keep doing it, right? When a Marine Corps general tells me that, he says it's a fabulous thing you do. When the head of a division of Swales Aerospace says to me, I sure hope you guys are going to keep doing this, I mean, that's pretty tremendous. We're still searching for a way to further lever those relationships, which is going to do some work, I think, ultimately for us in that regard. But by God, we're getting this program out of my hands when you pry it away from my cold, dead body. Right? This has been a really fabulous opportunity for the NAR.
Jack Haggerty, the other half of California. Just to follow up on that, there's peripheral fallout from this whole program in that, you know, our situation with our launch field. Well, it just so happens that the team that we mentored and qualified went on to take first place this year at TARC, and so we immediately ran that right up. We're putting that right at the top of every one of our field requests to show the value of the whole thing. You know.
Right.
And it's been tremendous at the section level, not just the national level.
And if I would strongly encourage you, if you've never been to the TARC finals, right, you should go to the TARC finals. It is the most fun you can have in a rock tree event where you won't fly a darn thing and you won't care. You cannot believe what goes on at the TARC until you've been there to experience it. It's absolutely fabulous. Anything else?
Would there be, Joe Holland, the reason possibility maybe to offer like a TARC alumni, discount or something for NAR membership, just to kind of attract these kids can't stay in it? Whether that would be, effective or not.
I'm not sure. These kids are pretty focused on what they do there and not necessarily, generally interested in rock tree. That's why I say the membership bump has been, tens, not hundreds. We put through, 40,000 kids through this program since we've been doing it.
Lynn Thomas, Indianapolis, did you make any effort to recruit any of them?
Yeah, we've made all kinds of effort to give them materials and the information and that sort of thing. So, yeah, we've done that. These kids, my experience in talking to them, part of what I do at the TARC finals is just wander around and talk to these kids, tell me about what you're up to and all this. I'm like, Jiminy Cricket, these kids are pretty busy. They've got, band and this and the online. They're going to be very busy kids, in that room on their schedule, family for one more thing.
Yeah, it's Bob Allwood from Otsego, very local. One comment I'd like to make is, we talked earlier about the $25 for the A&B division, and I know that's something when the issue has come up before the board and you've sent out messages to section leadership, but I've chimed in and said, please keep it as low as you can, and I and our section as a whole have really appreciated that because it allows us within our own section to do our recruiting of A&B or junior leader, depending on your perspective of proper membership name is. We've had various scholarships, either kid shows up with rockets to enough launches that will give them a membership, or if they come to one of our contests so we can milk them for points, we'll get them an NAR membership. But one of the benefits we've also found about this is from time to time we'll give the kid a membership, and pretty soon dad starts looking at this and finding it interesting, and we start getting adult memberships. So while we can't claim to have conquered the world with this, it's a slow plug along one at a time sort of a thing, and it has been very helpful. I'd like to collectively send my appreciation to the board for keeping those costs down because it's been helpful to us as a individual section.
Thanks. Mike Rankin from Saginaw. Do the TARC teams get support rockets?
Maybe you ought to spend a little time talking about TARC in general and some other things I know are on your mind. Let me point to Trip Barber, the NAR Vice President, and our National Committee.
I'm Trip Barber from Springfield, Virginia. We provide a copy of Sport Rocketry to every team that comes to the finals, the copy that has the previous year's finals article. And each team that registers and enters TARC gets about three emails during the course of the year with NAR advertisements, membership, the there's a special membership program for TARC where if the teacher joins, it's like a family, and the students can get the family rate if they join as a group with the teacher. So we do everything we can. We get a few dozen members out of it, but what we're really trying to do with TARC is to build our replacements. That is, kids who have a great experience with rocketry, and then they go off to college and, you know, join life, and about age 35, and they start having kids who are old enough to build rockets, they remember who we are, and they become the next generation of adults. It's a long-term program to find another generation to be, because the age bump that I'm in is marching to the right. In 15 years or 20 years, we're probably not going to be at NARAM much. And we need another generation to come along behind us. That's what we're trying to do with TARC.
Walker-friendly launch fields.
Yeah, we'll have walker-friendly launch fields. Yeah, right. So, Bob, I want to mention one other thing, though, while I'm standing up here. I run the National Events Committee. TARC is one of four national events. This is another one. And then there's NSL and NARCON. So each year, I have to deliver four miracles. And I have to find it.
And a damn fine job he does.
The miracle locker is getting a little low right now. We have NARAM next year arranged. NARHAMS has stepped forward and has agreed to hold NARAM at Great Meadow, which is normally the Novar field. It's also the TARC field. NARHAMS is going to run next year's NARAM. That's great. There'll be an old Rocketeers reunion as part of it. You'll hear more about it at the banquet. So NARAM next year is okay. I got TARC. Novar and the 110 NAR members who come to help run TARC have got that one. NSL and NARCON for next year are not spoken for. I thought I had a deal. They evaded me. So I really don't have a deal right now for next year's NSL and NARCON. Now, each year I got to find volunteer sections who want to step forward and do a little payback for the privilege of having been to many other people's national events. I ask every section to think about taking their turn. This year, SMASH, which is a relatively small section with not huge amounts of contest experience, said, hey, we'll do this. It's, you know, we go to these things, it's sort of our turn. We can do it. And they did. They're doing a nice job. Who's next year? Doesn't have to be a monster section like NARHAMS, but they've got NARAM covered. But NSL, NARCON is actually much different. It's a convention-type arrangement. Don't have to have a launch at all. An entirely different kind of section could do that. NSL is high-power-oriented. You need a high-power field. I need some volunteers. So if you could put the word out that the books are open, don't just assume that these things happen and somebody else has got it. I need some people to step forward. And in NARAM 51, I mean, I need to keep working about 2 years in the future to be bringing these consecutive miracles off and bringing you this quality service. So if you've not done one of these, or if it's been a few years since you have, please consider volunteering. I have a complete handbook of how to do it that I provide to anyone who's interested. And I provide all the management support you want, probably about 100% more than that. more than you want to make sure these things work. But I'll help. But I need somebody to take the first step and say, okay, I'm willing to consider it. What do I have to do? So that was my advertisement for the year. Thanks.
George Jeff, Wayne Norman, Alabama. I'd like to know, on the old Rocketeer reunion next year, is that going to be open or is there going to be some kind of a
Hello, I'm your old Rocketeer reunion coordinator. The way I have it planned is there's going to be a set number, which you'll find out in the flyer on Friday, and we'll get a special patch. But I plan to have the reunion on Saturday night open to anybody. I want old Rocketeers to mix with new Rocketeers, and I want history exchange documented. And think of it as a family reunion. And so we want the little NAR kids running around to find out about everything from the older kids running around. So that's my plan. It's not going to be restricted. You'll find out more on Friday.
Let me confuse things further by planting a seed in your mind. We've had informal discussions with NAR board members about this. I know, for example, Tripp is organizing a reunion of the MIT Rocket Society. That went back many years, has deep roots in the technology of our hobby. I would encourage you who are section leaders to go out there poking around and find out what happened to, for example, Mark Schmidt of NIRA, and see if you can dig him up, and you know, who knows, he might be living in the D.C. area, and get those people back in there. I think this is going to be a really fabulous event when I hear about some of the people who are coming, you know, longstanding NAR members who have disappeared from the scene who are going to pop back up. I'm in the process of twisting Pat Miller, my predecessor in this job's arm, to come and come back and regale us with the stories of, you know, doing things like trying to burn down the old hotel that was on NASA Road 1 and Houston and other late night places. And thank God there wasn't video surveillance back then or we'd all be dead. We'd be searching for that presidential pardon for sure. So please, you know, think about doing that as part of that old Rocketeers reunion as well. Anything else? If not, then I would entertain, I'm going to call the meeting out of recess. We're back in a formal business meeting now. And I would ask Jennifer Ashpole to please announce the results of the NAR election.
It's been so long, you guys are talking so much. All right. I want to thank Jerry King, Tom Ha, and Jack Haggerty for helping me count. You should have seen the shuffling of papers. That's great. A total number of 201 ballots were counted. The new NAR Board of Trustee members are Ben Sugley with 172 votes, Ted Cochran with 171 votes, and George Rocker with 160 votes. Art Applewhite got 67 votes, just so you guys all try not to do the math, it hurts. But those are your new Board of Trustee members. Anything else you need to know? She'll hand it over to me and our
Okay. There's no other business to be brought before the association, the chair would entertain a motion.
Motion to close.
Second.
It's in the bond world, that would have been an arbitrage trade we just took off.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for participating. I'd like any of our trustees to just gather here for a few minutes in the front room so we can make sure we got the schedule locked and closed.
Did you find your the stream that was going to the cornfield?
The one that was going south, the one that was going west.